Elizabeth had gone to spend the afternoon with Margaret. They were both English, but Margaret was much older, and they were also very different in character. But they were both in love with India, and it was this fact that drew them together. They sat on the veranda, and Margaret wrote letters and Elizabeth addressed the envelopes. Margaret always had letters to write. She led a busy life and was involved with several organizations of a charitable or spiritual nature. There were usually guests staying in Margaret's house. Sometimes they were complete strangers to her when they first arrived. Holy men, village welfare workers, organizers of conferences on spiritual welfare. She had one constant visitor throughout the winter, an elderly government officer who had taken to a spiritual life and gone to live in the mountains at Almora. He did not, however, very much care for the winter cold up there, so he came down to Delhi to stay with Margaret, who was always pleased to have him. He had a soothing effect on her, for he had cast anger and all other bitter passions out of his heart, and was consequently always smiling and serene. Everyone affectionately called him Babaji. He sat now with the two ladies, in a rocking chair, enjoying the winter sunshine and the flowers in the garden. His companions, however, were less serene. Margaret, in fact, was beginning to get angry with Elizabeth. This happened quite frequently, for Margaret tended to be quickly irritated, and especially with a meek and conciliatory person like Elizabeth. "It's very selfish of you," Margaret said now. Elizabeth flinched. Like many very unselfish people, she was always accusing herself of undue selfishness. But because it was not in her power to do what Margaret wanted, she compressed her lips and kept silent. "It's your duty to go," Margaret said. "I'm sorry, Margaret," Elizabeth said, utterly miserable, utterly ashamed. The worst of it was that she really wanted to go. What she was required to do was to take a party of little Tibetan orphans on a holiday treat to Agra and show them the Taj Mahal. Elizabeth loved children. She loved little trips and treats, and she loved the Taj Mahal, but she couldn't go. Nor could she say why. Of course, Margaret very easily guessed why, and it irritated her more than ever. She said bluntly, "Your Raju can do without you for those few days. Good heavens, you've been married 5 years."
"Four," Elizabeth said in a humble voice.
"Four, then. I can hardly be expected to keep count of each wonderful day."
Elizabeth glanced imploringly towards Babaji, but he was rocking and smiling and looking with tender love at two birds on the lawn.
"There are times when I can't help feeling you're afraid of him," Margaret said.
She ignored Elizabeth's little disclaiming cry of horror.
"Married life is nothing if it's not based on the twin rocks of trust and understanding."
Babaji liked this phrase so much that he repeated it to himself several times, his head nodding with approval.
"In everything I did," Margaret said, "Arthur had complete faith in me, and in those days, well, a wife like me wasn't altogether a joke."
Her late husband had been a high-up British official, and in those days he and Margaret had been expected to conform to some very strict social rules. Her friends nowadays often had a good laugh at the idea of Margaret conforming to those rules, and she had many stories of how she had shocked her fellow countrymen.
"As soon as I came here, I knew this was the place I belonged. It's funny, isn't it? I don't suppose there's any rational explanation for it. But then, when was India ever the place for rational explanations?"
Babaji said, with gentle certainty, "In your last birth, you were an Indian."
"Yes, lots of people have told me that. Mind you, in the beginning, it was quite a job to make them see it. It wasn't like today. I envy you girls married to Indians. You have a very easy time of it."
Elizabeth thought of the first time she had been taken to stay with Raju's family. She had met and married Raju in England, where he had gone for a year on a Commonwealth scholarship, and then had returned with him to Delhi. She couldn't speak any Hindi, and they spoke very little English, but they managed to make it clear at once that they thought her too ugly and too old for Raju, but that they did not hold this against her. They got a lot of amusement out of her, and she enjoyed being with them.
Various fertility ceremonies had been performed over her, and before she left, she'd been given her share of the family jewellery. "Elizabeth," Margaret said, "if you're going to be so slow, I'd rather do them myself." "Just these two left," Elizabeth said, bending eagerly over the envelope she was addressing. "For all your marriage, sometimes I wonder how much you do understand about this country. You live such a closed-in life." "I'll just take these inside," said Elizabeth, picking up the envelopes and letters. She wanted to get away. Not because she minded being told about her own wrong way of life, but because she was afraid Margaret might start talking about Raju again. It was cold inside, away from the sun. Margaret's house was old and massive, with thick stone walls and immensely high ceilings. It was designed to keep out the heat in summer, but it also sealed in the cold in winter. A stale smell of rice, curry, and mango chutney was chilled into the air. Elizabeth put the letters on Margaret's work table, which was in the drawing room. Besides the drawing room, there was a dining room. But every other room was a bedroom, each with its dressing room and bathroom attached. Sometimes Margaret had to put as many as 3 or 4 visitors into each bedroom. She was the soul of generosity, ever ready to throw open her house to any friend or acquaintance in need of shelter. She had thrown it open to Elizabeth and Raju 3 years ago, when they had had to vacate their rooms almost overnight, because the landlord said he needed the accommodation for his relatives. At first, Raju had been very grateful and had praised their hostess to the skies for her generous character. But as the weeks wore on, and every day, day after day, 2 or 3 times a day, they sat with Margaret and whatever other guests she had round the table, eating alternately lentils and rice or string beans with boiled potatoes and beetroot salad, with Margaret always in her chair at the head of the table, talking inexhaustibly about her ideas, about Indian spirituality and the mutiny and village uplift and the Industrial Revolution. Raju, who had a lot of ideas of his own and rather liked to talk, began to get restive. "But madam, madam," he would frequently say, half rising in his chair in his impatience to interrupt her, only to have to sit down again, unsatisfied, and continue with his dinner, because Margaret was too busy with her own ideas to have time to take in his. Once he could not restrain himself, Margaret said something that stirred Raju to such disagreement that he said out loud for everyone to hear, "Nonsense! She is only talking nonsense!" There was a moment's silence. Then Margaret, sensible woman that she was, shut her eyes as a sign that she would not hear and would not see, and repeating the sentence he had interrupted more firmly than before, continued her discourse on an even keel. It was the other person sitting with them round the table, a Buddhist monk with a large shaved skull, who had looked at Raju and very, very gently had clicked his tongue. Raju had felt angry and humiliated, and afterwards, when they were alone in their bedroom, he had quarrelled about it with Elizabeth. The noise of this must have disturbed Margaret, who suddenly stood in the doorway. Unfortunately, it was just at the moment when Raju, in his anger and frustration, was pulling his wife's hair, and they both stood frozen in this attitude and stared back at Margaret. The next instant, of course, they had collected themselves, and Raju let go of Elizabeth's hair, and she pretended as best she could that all that was happening was that he was helping her to comb it. But such a feeble subterfuge would not do before Margaret's penetrating eye, which kept fixed on Raju in total silence for 2 disconcerting minutes. Then she said, "We don't treat English girls that way," and withdrew, leaving the door open behind her as a warning that they were under observation. If they had had anywhere else to go, he would have moved out that instant. Raju never came to see Margaret now. He was a proud person, who would never forget anything he considered a slight to his honour. Elizabeth sighed as she arranged the letters on Margaret's work table. She was sad that this difference had arisen between her husband and her only friend, but she knew that there was nothing she could do about it. On the veranda,
Babaji and Margaret were discussing the relative merits of the three ways towards realization. They spoke of the way of knowledge, the way of action, and that of love. Margaret maintained, while she could appreciate the beauty of the other two ways, for herself there was no path but that of action. It was her nature.
"Of course it is," Babaji said, "and God bless you for it."
Arthur used to say, "Margaret was born to right all the wrongs of the world in one go, but I can't help it. It's not in me to sit still when I see things to be done."
"Babaji," said Elizabeth, laughing. "Once I saw her, it was during the monsoon, and the river had flooded and the people on the bank were being evacuated, but it wasn't being done quickly enough for Margaret. She waded into the water and came back with someone's tin trunk on her head. All the people shouted, 'Mem Sahib, Mem Sahib, what are you doing?' But she didn't take a bit of notice."
Elizabeth went pink with laughter and with pleasure and pride at recalling this incident. Margaret shook her head with a fond smile. "Yes, but if I'd been born with an ounce more patience, life could have been a lot smoother all round, don't you think so?"
Elizabeth said, "I love you just the way you are."
"Yes, that's the trouble with you. You love everybody just the way they are."
Of course, Margaret was referring to Raju. Elizabeth twisted her hands in her lap. These hands were large and bony and usually red, although she was otherwise a pale and rather frail person. The more anyone twisted and squirmed, the less inclined was Margaret to let them off the hook, not because this afforded her any pleasure, but because she felt that facts of character must be faced just as resolutely as any other kinds of fact.
"Don't think you're doing anyone a favour," she said, "by being so indulgent towards their faults. It's not mutual pampering that makes a marriage, but mutual trust."
Elizabeth knew that there was not much of these in her marriage. She wasn't even sure how much Raju earned in his job at the municipality. And there was one drawer in their bedroom whose contents she didn't know, for he always kept it locked and the key with him.
"I'll lend you a wonderful book," Margaret said. "Shafi!"
She called suddenly for the servant, but of course he couldn't hear, because the servant's quarters were right at the back.
"I'll fetch him," Elizabeth said.
She went back into the stone-cold house and out again to the kitchen and the crowded servant's quarters. Margaret could never bear to dismiss anyone, and even the servants who were no longer in her employ continued to enjoy her hospitality. Each servant had a great number of dependents, so this part of the house was a little colony of its own, with a throng of people chatting or sleeping or quarrelling or squatting on the ground to cook their meals and wash their children.
"Shafi," Elizabeth said, "Mem Sahib is calling you."
The old man mumbled furiously. He didn't like Elizabeth. In fact, he didn't like any of the visitors. He was so old that he had been Arthur's bearer when Arthur was still a bachelor and serving in the districts, almost 40 years ago. Still grumbling, he followed Elizabeth back to the veranda.
"Tea, Shafi," Margaret called out cheerfully when she saw them coming.
"Not time for tea yet," he said.
She laughed. She loved it when her servants answered her back. She felt it showed a sense of ease and equality and family irritability, which was only another side of family devotion.
"What a cross old man you are," she said. "It's hard to believe," Margaret went on, "that this old scarecrow is a terrible snob. You know why he doesn't like you, Elizabeth? Because you're married to an Indian."
Elizabeth smiled and blushed. She admired Margaret's forthrightness.
"He thinks you've let down the side. He's got very firm principles. He thinks I've let down the side, too. All his life he's longed to work for a real Mem Sahib, the sort that entertains other Mem Sahibs to tea."
The old man's face began working strangely. His mouth and stubbled cheeks twitched, and then sounds started coming that rose and fell. He spoke partly in English and partly in Hindi, and it was some time before it could be made out that he was telling some story of the old days, a party at the Gymkhana Club, for which he had been hired as an additional waiter.
"Very grand," said Margaret. "Now, you run along and get our tea."
"There was little Mizzy Saab, too. She had two ayahs, and every year they were given 4 saris, and one shawl for the winter. Tea, Shafi, Margaret said more firmly, so that the old man, who knew every inflection in his mistress's voice, saw it was time to be off.
Arthur and I have spoiled him outrageously, Margaret said. We spoiled all our servants.
God will reward you, said Babaji.
We could never think of them as servants, really. They were more our friends. I've learned such a lot from Indian servants. They're usually rogues, but underneath all that, they have beautiful characters. They're very religious, and they have a lot of philosophy. Now, if you had a servant, Elizabeth, you could get around a bit more, instead of always having to dance attendance on your husband's mealtimes. I suppose that's why you don't want to take those poor little children to Agra.
It's not that I don't want to, Elizabeth said.
Quite apart from anything else, you ought to be longing to get round and see the country.
One day you will come and visit me in Almora, Babaji said.
Oh, Babaji, I'd love to, Elizabeth exclaimed.
Beautiful, he said,
spreading his hands to describe it all.
Mountains, trees, clouds.
Words failed him, and he could only smile into the distance as if he saw a beautiful vision there. Elizabeth smiled with him. She saw it too, although she had never been there. Margaret began to tell about all the places she had been to. She and Arthur had been posted to many different parts of the country, but that hadn't been enough for her. She had to see everything. She had no fears about travelling on her own, and had spent weeks tramping around in the mountains. She had travelled many miles by any mode of transport available, train, bus, cycle, rickshaw, or even bullock cart, in order to see some little-known temple or cave or tomb.
That's the way to get to know a country, she declared.
Her cheeks were flushed with the pleasure of remembering everything she had done. Elizabeth agreed with her. Yet although she herself had done none of these things, she didn't feel that she was on that account cut off from all knowledge. There was much to be learned from living with Raju's family in Ankhpur. Much to be learned from Raju himself. Yes, he was her India. She felt like laughing when this thought came to her, but it was true.
Your trouble is, Margaret suddenly said, you let Raju bully you.
Again, Elizabeth wanted to laugh. She thought of the nice times she and Raju often had together. He'd invented a game of cricket that they could play in their bedroom with a rubber ball and a hairbrush, and three steps made a run. Raju's favourite trick was to hit the ball under the bed, and while she lay flat on the floor groping for it, he made run after run, exhorting her with mocking cries of, "Hurry up! Where is it? Can't you find it?" His eyes glittered with the pleasure of winning. His shirt was off, and drops of perspiration trickled down his smooth, dark chest.
"You should want to do something for those poor children."
"I do want to. You know I do."
"I don't know anything of the sort. All I see is you leading an utterly useless, selfish life. I'm disappointed in you, Elizabeth. You're not serious at all. You're as frivolous as any of those girls that come here and spend their days playing mahjong."
Elizabeth was ashamed. The worst of it was, she really had once been a serious person. She had been a schoolteacher in England, and devoted to her work and her children. But all that had come to an end once she met Raju.
"It's criminal to be in India and not be committed," Margaret went on, "to do nothing at all. No, I wouldn't be able to sleep at nights."
And Elizabeth slept not only well, but happily, blissfully. Sometimes she turned on the light just for the pleasure of looking at Raju lying beside her. He slept like a child, with the pillow bundled under his cheek and his mouth slightly open as if he were smiling.
"But what are you laughing at?"
I'm not, Margaret. She hastily composed her face. She hadn't been aware of it, but probably she had been smiling at the image of Raju asleep. Margaret abruptly pushed back her chair. Her face was red and her hair dishevelled as if she'd been in a fight. Elizabeth half rose in her chair, aghast at whatever it was she had done and eager to undo it.
"Don't follow me," Margaret said. "If you do, I know I'm going to behave badly and I'll feel terrible afterwards."
She went inside the house and the screen door banged after her. Elizabeth sank down into her chair and looked helplessly at Babaji. He had remained as serene as ever. The winter afternoon was drawing to its close, and the sun, caught between two trees, was beginning to contract into one concentrated area of gold. Though the light was failing, the garden remained bright and gay with all its marigolds, its phlox, its pansies, and its sweet peas. Babaji enjoyed it all. He sat wrapped in his woolen shawl with his feet warm in thick knitted socks and sandals.
"She is a hot-tempered lady," he said, smiling and forgiving. "But good, good."
"Oh, I know," Elizabeth said. "She's an angel. I feel so bad that I should have upset her." She bit her lip in vexation at herself. Shafi came out with the tea tray, but did not put it down.
"Where is she?" he said.
"It's all right, Shafi. She's just coming. Put it down, please."
The old man nodded and smiled in a cunning, superior way. He clutched his tray more tightly and turned back into the house.
"Shafi," Elizabeth called after him, "Babaji wants his tea."
But he didn't even turn round. He walked straight up to Margaret's bedroom and kicked the door and shouted, "I've brought it." Elizabeth hurried after him. She felt nervous about going into Margaret's bedroom after having been so explicitly forbidden to follow her. But Margaret only looked up briefly from where she was sitting reading a letter and said,
"Oh, it's you."
When he had put down the tea, Shafi went out again and the two of them were left alone. Margaret's bedroom was quite different from the rest of the house. The other rooms were all bare and cold, but Margaret's room was crammed with a lot of comfortable, solid old furniture, dominated by the big double bed in the centre. A log fire burned in the grate, and there were photographs everywhere. The stale smell of food pervading the rest of the house stopped short of this room, which was scented very pleasantly by wood smoke and lavender water.
"It's from my sister," Margaret said, indicating the letter she was reading. "She lives out in the country and they've been snowed under again.
She's always wanted me to come home.
I couldn't live in England anymore. I couldn't bear it."
"Yes, I know what you mean."
"What do you know? You've only been here a few years. Oh, pour the tea, there's a dear."
Margaret took off her sandals and lay down on the bed, leaning against some fat pillows that she had propped against the headboard.
"I brought my sister out here once," Margaret said, "but she couldn't stand it, couldn't stand anything. The climate, the water, the food, everything made her ill. Of course, I'm just the opposite."
"You like it here too, don't you?"
"Very, very much."
"Yes, I can see that you're happy."
Margaret looked at her so keenly that Elizabeth tried to turn away her face slightly. She didn't want anyone to see too much of her tremendous happiness. She felt somewhat ashamed of herself for having it, not only because she knew she didn't deserve it, but also because she didn't consider herself quite the right kind of person to have it. She had been over 30 when she met Raju, and had not expected much more out of life than had up till then been given to her. Margaret lit a cigarette. Suddenly she said,
"He doesn't like me, does he?"
"Who?"
"Who? You're Raju, of course."
Elizabeth flushed with embarrassment.
"How you talk, Margaret," she murmured, not knowing what else to say.
"I know he doesn't," Margaret said. "I can always tell."
She sounded so sad that Elizabeth wished she could lie to her and say, no, Raju loved her just as everyone else did, but she couldn't bring herself to it. She thought of the way he usually spoke of Margaret. He called her by rude names and made coarse jokes about her, at which he laughed like a schoolboy and tried to make Elizabeth laugh with him. And the terrible thing was, sometimes she did laugh. Now, when she thought of this compliant laughter of hers, she was filled with anguish, and she began unconsciously to wring her hands the way she always did at such secretly appalling moments. But Margaret was smiling to herself. She said,
"You know what was my happiest time of all in India?
About 10 years ago, when I went to stay in Swami Vishwananda's ashram.
Elizabeth was intensely relieved at the change of subject, though somewhat puzzled by its abruptness.
We bathed in the river and we walked in the mountains. It was a time of such freedom, such joy. I've never felt like that before or since. In the evenings, we all sat with Swamiji. We talked about everything under the sun. That's him over there.
She nodded towards a small framed photograph on the dressing table.
He didn't look different from the rest of India's holy men, naked to the waist with long hair and burning eyes.
Not that you can tell much from a photo, Margaret said. She looked at it herself with a very young expression on her face.
He was such fun to be with, always full of jokes and games. When I was with him, I used to feel...
I don't know.
Like a flower or a bird.
She laughed, and Elizabeth laughed with her.
Does Raju make you feel like that?
Elizabeth stopped laughing and looked down into her lap. She tried to make her face very serious so as not to give herself away.
Indian men have such marvellous eyes, Margaret said. When they look at you, you can't help feeling all young and nice.
Margaret stubbed out her cigarette and got up.
Poor old Babaji is waiting for his tea.
She poured it for him and went out with the cup. Elizabeth went after her. Babaji was just where they had left him, except that now the sun was even more intensely gold and provided a heavenly background, as if to a saint in a picture, as he sat there at peace in his rocking chair. Margaret fussed over him. She stirred his tea and she arranged his shawl more securely over his shoulders. Then she said,
I've got an idea, Babaji. You and I'll take those children up to Agra. Would you like that, a little trip?
She looked up into his face and was eager and bright.
We'll hire a bus and we'll have singing and games all the way. You'll love it.
She squeezed his knee in anticipatory joy. And he smiled at her. And his thin old hand came down on the top of her head in a gesture of affection or blessing.